You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a collected work by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Bhagavad Gita and the West, which is separated into two parts. This is Lecture 2 of the lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Bhagavad Gita and the Epistles of Paul. It is entitled The Fundamental Concepts of the Gita, the Veda, Sankhya, and Yoga, given on December 29th, 1912. As mentioned yesterday, the Bhagavad Gita has been said to be the most significant philosophical poem ever produced, and anyone who studies it seriously will find this statement fully justified. Attention will be drawn in these lectures to the artistic merit of the Gita, but above all to the significance of its mighty underlying thoughts and the lofty knowledge of the world from which it grew and for whose glorification it was created. Looking thus into the foundations of the Gita becomes especially important, because it is certain that in all its essentials, particularly those related to thought and knowledge, it is communicated to us from a pre-Buddhistic age. So we can say it is the spiritual horizon surrounding the great Buddha, out of which he developed, that is characterized for us in the content of the Gita. It lets us see the spiritual constitution of the ancient pre-Buddhistic Indian civilization. We have already emphasized that the thoughts of the Gita are an organic blending of three spiritual streams, moving and living within one another in such a way that they are seen as one. What is found in the Gita is a unified whole, as a spiritual expression of primeval Indian thinking and perception, is a beautifully grand and immeasurable view of spiritual knowledge, so vast that modern man, not yet acquainted with spiritual science, cannot but doubt the grandeur of its dimensions, for he has no possibility of gaining a point of view regarding these depths of knowledge. Ordinary modern methods of research do not help one to penetrate these depths. At most, these methods only make it possible to look upon the Gita as a beautiful dream, once dreamt by mankind, that may inspire wonder, but can have no value for science. Those who have studied spiritual science, however, will be amazed at the depths of the Gita, and will admit that in primeval ages the human spirit penetrated into knowledge that can only be attained again through the gradual development of spiritual organs. This arouses admiration for the insight shown in those past ages, because out of world content itself we are able now to rediscover and confirm the truth of it. How wonderful it really was that those primeval men were able to raise themselves to such spiritual heights. To be sure, mankind in those days was especially favored in possessing the remains of an old clairvoyance that was still alive in human souls. Not only were men led into the spiritual worlds through the use of special exercises in meditation, but the science of that time was impregnated, in a certain sense, by the knowledge and ideas provided by the remains of the old clairvoyance. Today we recognize, for quite other reasons, the accuracy of what has been handed down to us from that source. But we must understand that in that ancient time, delicate distinctions concerning the being of man were arrived at by other means than they are today. Subtle, astute concepts were drawn from what men could know, concepts that were clearly outlined and that could be applied to spiritual as well as to external physical reality. Thus we find it possible to understand their ancient point of view, if in some instances we only transpose the terms we use today for our changed point of view. In our spiritual research, we have sought to present things as they appear to contemporary clairvoyant perception, so that our kind of spiritual science represents what can be attained today by spiritually minded men out of their own effort. In the early days of theosophical teaching, less was done by means derived directly out of occult science than by methods aided by the designations and nuances of concepts used in the East, namely, those that had been carried over by old tradition from the time of the Gita right into our present time. For this reason, the older form of theosophical development, to which have now been added our present methods of occult investigation, worked more through concepts preserved in tradition, especially the concepts of the Sankhya philosophy. The Sankhya philosophy itself, however, underwent a gradual change through the alteration of thinking in the East, and at the beginning of the theosophical movement, the being of man and other secrets were described in the later terminology of Sankara-karya. The great reformer of Vedic and other Indian knowledge in the 8th century A.D. Sankara-karya, I'm going to spell his name, S-A-N-K-A-R-A-C-H-A-R-Y-A. I'm going to pronounce that Sankara-karya. We will pay less attention today to the expressions chosen at the beginning of the theosophical movement. But in order to get to the foundations of the knowledge and wisdom of the Gita, let us look rather into the primeval Indian wisdom found especially in the Sankhya philosophy. We will best understand how the being and nature of man were considered in the Sankhya philosophy if we keep in mind the fact that a spiritual seed is inherent in every human being. This fact has often been expressed by saying that in a human soul, forces are slumbering that will gradually emerge in the course of human evolution. The highest we can see now, and that man will in future attain, is called spirit man. Even when man has risen to the stage of spirit man, he will still have to distinguish between the soul that dwells within him and spirit man itself. Just as today a distinction must be made between our innermost soul and the sheaths that enclose it, the astral, etheric, and physical bodies. Just as we consider these bodies as sheaths, distinguished from the soul itself, which for the present human cycle is divided into three parts, the sentient, intellectual, and consciousness souls, just as we thus distinguish between the threefold nature of the soul itself and its system of sheaths, so in future we shall have to reckon with the soul itself, that will then be divided in a way corresponding to our present sentient, intellectual, and consciousness souls. And the sheath nature will then have reached the stage of development we call spirit man. But the human sheath, in which, so to say, the spirit-soul core of man's being will be enclosed, the spirit man, will only have significance for him in the future. Nevertheless, that into which a being is to develop is always in existence. The substance of spirit man, in which our souls will one day be ensheathed, has always been in the great universe, and is there at the present time. Today other beings already have sheaths that will some day form our spirit man. Thus the substance of which the human spirit man will one day consist already exists in the universe. This fact, derived from our teaching, was already known to the old Sankhya doctrine. What exists in the universe in an undifferentiated, non-individualized state, flowing like spiritual water, filling space and time, and providing the basis from which all forms, past, present, and future, come forth, was known by the Sankhya philosophy as the highest form of substance. It is that substance which this philosophy considered as continuing from age to age. Let me read that again. It is that substance which this philosophy considered as continuing from age to age. Just as we speak of the beginning of our earth evolution, and of how all to which the earth has since evolved was present in spirit as substantial spiritual being, so did the Sankhya philosophy speak of its original substance, of its primordial flood, from which all forms, physical and superphysical, have developed. This highest form is not yet relevant for contemporary man, but, as has been shown, the day will come when it will be. The next form that will evolve out of the primal flowing substance, coming from above downward, we recognize as the second principle of man, the life spirit, or to use an Eastern expression, buddhi. Again, our teaching tells us that man will, in the normal course, develop buddhi only at a future stage. but as a spiritual form principle, it has always been present in other superhuman beings, and was thus the first form differentiated from the primal flowing substance. According to the Sankhya philosophy, Buddhi arose out of the first form of non-soul substantial existence. Now, when we consider the further evolution of the substantial principle, there appears a third form, which the Sankhya philosophy calls Ahankara, whereas Buddhi stands, as it were, on the border of the principle of differentiation, and merely suggests individualization, the form of Ahankara appears as completely differentiated. When Ahankara is spoken of, therefore, we must imagine Buddhi as organized downward into independent, real, substantial forms that then exist individually in the world. To create a picture of this evolution, let us imagine as the primal substantial principle an equally distributed mass of water. Then it wells up so that forms appear, not as separate drops, but as forms that emerge like little mounds of water from the common substance, with their bases still in the primal common flow. This condition would represent Buddhi. If we further imagine these mounds of water detaching themselves into drops, into independent spheres, we would have the form of Ahankara. Then, through a certain thickening of the individualized form of each separate soul form of Ahankara, there would originate what is designated as Manas. Here we must admit that the naming of these sheaths differs slightly from our designations. In considering human evolution from above downward, according to our teaching, spirit self, Manas, follows after life spirit or Buddhi. This designation is absolutely correct for the present cycle of humanity, and in the course of these lectures it will be shown why. We do not insert Ahankara between Buddhi and Manas, but for our concepts we unite it with Manas, and the two together are called spirit self. In those past ages it was quite justifiable to consider them as separate for a reason that I shall only indicate today and later develop further. At that time one could not use the important characteristic that must be employed today if we want to be understood. I am speaking of the influences of Lucifer on the one side and of Ahriman on the other. This characteristic is absolutely lacking in the Sankhya philosophy, for in a human constitution that had no occasion to look toward these two principles, because it could not yet feel any trace of their force, it was quite justifiable to slip in the differentiated form of Ahankara between Buddhi and Manas. So when Manas is spoken of in the sense of the Sankhya philosophy, it is not the same as when spoken of in the sense of Sankarakarya, who considered Manas identical with spirit self, even though Manas differs in the sense of the Sankhya philosophy. We are still able to characterize clearly what Manas actually is in this sense. Let us then consider man living his physical existence in the sense world. In his physical existence he lives in such a way that he perceives the reality of his surroundings by means of his senses. Through his sense of touch, by means of his hands and feet, by handling things, walking and speaking, he has an effect upon the surrounding physical world. So expressed, this agrees entirely with the Sankhya philosophy. But how does a man perceive the surrounding world by means of his senses? Well, with his eyes he sees light and color, light and dark, and the shape of things. With his ears he perceives sounds. With his olfactory organs he senses odors. And with his organs of taste he receives taste impressions. Each separate sense is a means of becoming aware of a particular part of the external world. He opens himself to it through these doors of his being called the senses. But with each sense he approaches one limited area of the world. Something like a unifying principle in us combines these different areas of the outer world for us, as even our ordinary language shows. We speak, for instance, of warm and cold colors, although we know that this is only a manner of speaking, and that in reality we become aware of cold and warmth through the organs of touch, and light and dark colors through the organ of sight. When we speak of warm and cold colors, out of this feeling of inner relationship, We are using terms appropriate to one sense in describing the others. We express ourselves in this way because in our inner being there is a kind of intermingling between what we perceive through sight and what impresses us through the sense of want. More delicately sensitive people, on hearing certain sounds, can inwardly form ideas of color. They may, for example, associate certain tones with red, others with blue. Some activity within us, therefore, holds together the separate senses and makes out of their separate activities a unity for the soul. If one is sensitive, one can go even further. There are people who may, on entering a town, experience an impression of yellow. In another town, they may experience red, in others, white or blue. Much of the totality of our impressions expresses itself inwardly to us as color. The separate sense impressions are thus united inwardly in an overall collective sense that does not belong to any one sense alone. It lives in our inner being and floods us with its quality of wholeness by incorporating the individual sense impressions into it. It may be called the inner sense. It may all the more be called so because all the usual inner experiences of sorrow and joy, passions and emotions, are united again with what this inner sense offers us, so that we can also describe some emotions as dark and cold, others as warm and full of light. Thus we can also say our inner being, in turn, has any effect upon what forms the inner sense. Therefore, in contradistinction to the several senses directed to the different areas of the external world, we can speak of one that fills the soul. It is not connected with any single sense organ, but uses the whole being as its instrument. To describe this inner sense as manas is quite in harmony with the Sankhya philosophy. According to it, what organizes this inner sense into substance develops out of ahankara as a later product in the world of forms. So it can be said that first there was the primal flood, then buddhi, then ahankara, and then manas that is found within us as our inner sense. If we want to understand this inner sense, we proceed today in such a way as to see how our separate sense perceptions join in a common inner sense. This is the way we proceed today because our process of cognition travels along a reverse path as compared with that of ancient times. When we look at the development of our way of knowing, we see how it starts from the differentiation of the separate senses and then seeks to rise to the unified inner sense. Evolution was the other way around. In the developing world, manas first evolved out of ahankara, then the primal substance, the forces that form the separate senses as we carry them within us, differentiated themselves. This does not refer to the material sense organs that belong to the physical body, but to the forces underlying these organs, the formative forces that are wholly supersensible. So when we descend through the stages of the evolution of forms, we come down from ahankara to manas in the sense of the Sankhya philosophy. Then manas differentiates into separate forms and yields those supersensible forces that build up our separate senses. Because the soul is involved in viewing these separate senses, it is possible to bring the content of the Sankhya philosophy in line with our teaching. This philosophy tells us that inasmuch as manas has differentiated into the separate world forces of the senses, the soul has immersed itself in these different forms, but has remained distinct from them. Inasmuch as it does so, and also submerges itself in manas, it works through, is interwoven with, and is entwined in these sense forces. As a result, the soul, as spirit soul being, places itself in connection with the external world in order to feel pleasure and sympathy in it. For instance, the forces that constitute the I, EYE, have become differentiated out of manas. At an earlier stage, when the physical body of man did not exist in its present form, so says Sankhya philosophy, the soul was immersed only in the forces that constitute the I, EYE. We know that the human I of today was laid down germinally in the old Saturn time. Yet only after the withdrawal of the warmth organ which is to be found today in a stunted form in the pineal gland, did the eye develop, which is to say comparatively late. The forces out of which it evolved were already there in supersensible form, and the soul lived within them. The Samkhya philosophy also points out that because the soul lives in this principle of differentiation, it is attached to and develops a thirst for existence in the external world. Through the forces of the senses, the soul is connected with the external world, hence its inclination and longing for worldly existence. In a way, the soul sends feelers out through the sense organs, and by its forces is connected with outer existence. This connection by way of forces, understood as a real sum of forces, we understand to be the astral body of man. The Samkhya philosophy speaks of the combined working of the separate sense forces, which at this stage are differentiated from manas. Out of these sense forces, the finer elements arise, which we understand as the human etheric body. This etheric body is a comparatively late development. So we must picture to ourselves that evolution has taken place in this order, primal flood, buddhi, ahankara, manas, the substances of the senses, and the finer elements. In the outer world of the kingdom of nature, these finer elements also exist in the plants as etheric body. In the sense of the Samkhya philosophy, we have to imagine that the development of every plant has its origin in the primal flood, which has carried out a whole evolution from above downward. In the case of the plant, however, this all takes place in the supersensible, and only becomes real in the physical world when it densifies into the finer elements that live in its etheric body. With man, it is different. In his present development, the higher forms and principles of manas have already revealed themselves physically. The separate sense organs have appeared externally. With the plant, there is first found that later product that arises when the sense substance densifies into the finer etheric elements, whose further densification produces the coarse elements of which all physical things consist that we encounter in the outer world. When we go then from below upward, as we can see in the sense of the Samkhya philosophy, how man is membered into a coarse physical body, into the finer etheric body, into an astral body, an expression not used in Samkhya philosophy, but instead force body, which constitutes the sense organs. Next, into an inner sense, manas. Then in ahankara, the principle underlying human individuality, which enables man to have not only an inner sense for perceiving the separate areas of the senses in the outer world, but also for feeling himself as a separate individual being. Following ahankara come the higher principles that first appear in man as buddhi, and in what other Eastern philosophy customarily calls atma, recognized in its cosmic meaning by the Samkhya philosophy as the spiritual primal flood previously described. Thus, in the Samkhya philosophy, the constitution of man is presented completely, how in the past, present, and future his soul is ensheathed in the substantial external nature principle, the word nature meaning not only the outwardly visible, but all stages of nature up to the invisible. In prakriti, that is, in all the forms from the coarse physical body up to the primal flood, dwells purusha, the spirit-soul element, which is imagined as being monadic in every individual soul. The separate monadic souls, therefore, are to be thought of as without beginning and without end, just as the material prakriti principle, which is not material in our materialistic sense, is also thought of as without beginning or end. A multiplicity of individual souls is thus imagined, that plunged into the prakriti principle and developed downward from the highest differentiated form of the primal flood, with which they surrounded themselves to embodiment in coarse physical bodies. Having reached this lowest stage, and having overcome the physical body, they turn back and evolve upward again, thus returning to the primal flood. Finally, they free themselves even from it and enter as free souls into pure purusha. That word is P-U-R P-U-R-U-S-H-A, Purusha. When we allow this knowledge to act upon us, we see that this primal ancient wisdom is based upon what we can attain again today by means of our meditation. The Sankhya philosophy also shows that it has insight into the way the soul may be united with each of these form principles. The soul may, for example, be connected with Buddhi in such a way that within Buddhi it realizes its full independence as much as is possible in it. In such a case, the soul nature, not Buddhi, predominates. The opposite may also occur. The soul may enwrap its independence in a sort of sleep, envelop it in lassitude and laziness, so that the sheath nature is most prominent in such a way that every moment, gesture and look, communicated by the coarse physical body, recedes before the fact that the spirit-soul nature is expressing itself within him. We have a man before us, whom we see in the coarse physical body that stands there. Yet in his movements, gestures, and look, something appears that makes us say, quote, "This man is entirely spirit and soul, and he only needs the physical principle as a means of expression. The physical principle does not overpower him. He is everywhere, the master over it." Unquote. This condition, in which the soul is master of the external sheath principle, is the sattva condition. It may manifest as well in the soul's relation to buddhi and manas as in its relation to the body with its fine and coarse elements. To say that the soul lives in sattva means nothing else than a certain relation to the soul, to its envelope, of the spiritual principle in the soul with relation to the nature principle, of the purusha principle in relation to the prakriti principle. But we can also see how a man's coarse physical body quite dominates him. Parenthesis, no reference to moral characterizations is intended here, but only pure characterizations, as they exist in the sense of Sankhya philosophy. When seen with spiritual eyes, no moral consideration whatever is involved. Parenthesis. Such a man may appear to walk about weighed down by his physical body. He may have put on so much flesh that his whole appearance seems influenced by his weight, making it difficult for him to express his soul in his external physical body. When a man moves the muscles of his face in harmony with the speaking of his soul, the sattva principle is master. When quantities of fat imprint a special physiognomy on a man's face, the soul principle is then overpowered by the external sheath condition, and the soul's relation to the nature principle is that of tamas, T-A-M-A-S. When a balance exists between the sattva and the tamas states, when neither the soul has mastery, as in the sattva state, nor the external sheath nature, as in the tamas condition, when both are in equilibrium, the condition may be called rajas. Sattva, rajas, and tamas are the three gunas, and are of special importance. We must distinguish, then, between the characteristics of the separate forms of prakriti and the highest principle of undifferentiated primal substance, down to the coarse physical body. This sheath principle is one characteristic. The other is what the Sankhya philosophy characterizes as the relation of the soul nature to the sheaths, regardless of what the particular form of the sheath may be. This characteristic is revealed through the three conditions, sattva, rajas, and tamas. When the profound depths of such knowledge are brought into view, and an attempt is made to visualize how deep an insight into the secrets of existence this science had, in order that it might give such a comprehensive description of living beings, our souls become filled with admiration. We say to ourselves that it is one of the most amazing occurrences in the evolutionary history of mankind that a knowledge appearing again today in our spiritual science out of the dark spiritual depths should have already existed in those ancient times, obtained as it was by different methods. All this knowledge existed previously, and it is perceived again when our spiritual attention is directed to those primeval times. Let us now turn to the succeeding ages. We see what is usually referred to as the spiritual life of the different periods, the old Greek age, the following Roman age, and the Christian Middle Ages. We turn from these older cultures to modern times, to our age in which spiritual science brings us something that has grown out of the primal wisdom of mankind. As we survey all this, we can say that often throughout these ages, even the smallest glimmering of that primeval knowledge is lacking. Gradually, the knowledge of that grandiose sphere of existence, with its supersensible, all-embracing, ancient perception, was lost. Indeed, the purpose of evolution for 3,000 years has been to replace that primal wisdom with external knowledge of the material, physical plane. Nevertheless, it is interesting to see how in the age of Greek philosophy there still remained on the physical plane something like an echo of the old Sankhya knowledge. Echoes of the real nature of the soul are still to be found with Aristotle, but they are no longer such as can be clearly connected with the ancient Sankhya knowledge. Aristotle still divides the human being into the coarse physical body, though he scarcely mentions it, and into what he believes to be the soul nature, whereas the Sankhya philosophy knows these are only the sheaths. Then there is the vegetative soul, which would coincide with the finer elemental body in the sense of the Sankhya philosophy. Where Aristotle believes he is expressing something soul-like, he characterizes only the relations between soul and body, the gunas. In this he describes merely sheath forms. Then that which reaches out into the sphere of the senses, into what we call the astral body, Aristotle indicates as a soul principle. He no longer clearly distinguishes the soul from the bodily part, because for him the soul has already been submerged in the bodily shape. He differentiates rather the aestheticon, and distinguishes further in the soul the orecticon, kineticon, and the dianoeticon. Footnote: Friedrich Hebel explains these terms in the following way. The human physical body as a mere mineral substance is sarx, S-A-R-X. This Greek word sarx, for body, means that which is contained in the sarcophagus, the coffin. The principle which makes the body alive and lets it rise from the sarcophagus is threpticon, the vegetative or nutritive soul. Furthermore, the living being has the soul of sensitiveness, aestheticon, the soul of desiring, orecticon, and the soul of moving and understanding, kineticon. Man alone, among all living beings, has reason, noesis. This appears in its highest aspect as dianoeticon. The dianoeticon comes from the spiritual world, from nous, end quote from the Gospel of Hellas at the Basophic Press Incorporated, 1949, page 247, end of footnote. These to him are gradations of the soul, but there is no longer a clear distinction between the soul and its various sheaths. Aristotle believes he is presenting a classification of the soul, while the Sankhya philosophy grasped the soul in its own being as a monad, and all its differentiations were, so to say, covered by the sheath or the prakriti principle. Therefore, with Aristotle, there is no longer a remembrance of that primal knowledge found in the Sankhya philosophy. When, however, in the material domain, he speaks of light and darkness and colors, what he has to say is like a surviving echo of the principle of the three conditions. There are some colors, he says, that have more darkness in them, and others more light, and still others between these two. In the colors ranging between blue and violet, darkness predominates over light. So a color is blue or violet because darkness prevails in it. It is green or greenish-yellow when light and darkness are more nearly in equilibrium. A color is reddish or orange when the light principle overrules the dark. The Sankhya philosophy contains this principle of three conditions for the whole compass of world phenomena. It is sattva, for example, when the spiritual predominates over the natural. Aristotle uses the same characteristic when speaking of colors. He did not use the word sattva, but it would be correct to say that red and reddish-yellow represent the sattva condition of light. This terminology was no longer used by Aristotle, but he still retained the principle of the old Sankhya philosophy, where green represents the rajas condition, as regards light and darkness, and blue and violet, in which darkness predominates, represent the tamas condition. Even though Aristotle did not use these terms, the whole way of thinking that is found in the Sankhya philosophy regards light and darkness, and blue and violet, in which darkness predominates, represent the tamas condition. Even though Aristotle did not use these terms, the whole way of thinking that is found in the Sankhya philosophy regarding its spiritual grasp of world conditions shone into him. Hence his teachings on color were an echo of this old philosophy. Even this echo, however, was lost. We find the first glimmering of the reappearance of the three conditions, sattva, rajas, and tamas, in the external world of color, in the hard battle that Goethe carried on. For after the old Aristotelian division of the world of color into conditions of sattva, rajas, and tamas had been completely obliterated, so to say, it reappeared in Goethe. Today Goethe's system of color, brought to birth out of the principles of spiritual wisdom, has been subjected to blasphemy by modern physicists. From their own standpoint, of course, they are right in disagreeing with Goethe, but it only shows that in these matters they have been abandoned by all the good gods. That is fitting for contemporary physicists, who may therefore cast abuse upon Goethe's teachings concerning color. If modern genuine science wanted to make any connection with occult principles, it ought directly, today, to stand up for Goethe's theory of color. For in it is to be found again, in the midst of our scientific culture, what once reigned as the spiritual principle in the Sankhya philosophy. You can understand why, many years ago, I set myself the task of bringing forward Goethe's color theory to be evaluated as a physical science, while resting upon occult principles. For it is wholly relevant to say that Goethe's division of color phenomena represents the three states of sattva, rajas, and tamas. So, gradually, as out of spiritual darkness into a new chapter of spiritual history, new methods bring forth what humanity once attained by entirely different means. This Sankhya philosophy was pre-Buddhistic, as is obvious from the legend of the Buddha. The Indian teaching rightly relates that Kapila was the founder of the Sankhya philosophy. The birth of Buddha in the dwelling place of Kapila, in Kapila Vastu, indicates that he had his roots in the Sankhya teaching. His very birth placed him at the spot where that personality once worked who was the first to formulate the great Sankhya philosophy. Now imagine the relation of this Sankhya doctrine to the other spiritual currents we have mentioned, yet not as many Orientalists, and as the Jesuit Joseph Dalman presents it today. In various parts of ancient India lived men who had become differentiated in accordance with these three spiritual streams, since by that time the primal state of human evolution no longer existed. In Northeast India, for example, human nature was such that it inclined to the concepts given in the Sankhya philosophy. In an area more to the west, the tendency was to conceive of the world according to the Vedic doctrine. The different spiritual nuances arise, therefore, out of the differently gifted human natures in the different parts of India. Only later, through the Vedantists, having carried their work further, much out of the Sankhya philosophy had been worked in with the Vedas as we now have them. Yoga, the third spiritual current, arose because the old clairvoyance had gradually diminished and new ways to the spiritual world had to be sought. Yoga differs from the Sankhya point of view in that the latter is the view of a genuine science, a science of outer forms, which actually only grasps these forms and the way the human soul is interrelated with them. How the soul is to develop in order to reach to the spiritual worlds is indicated by yoga. What was an Indian man to do who, at a comparatively later time, wanted to develop himself in a way that would not be one-sided? What was he to do if he wished not merely to advance by concerning himself with external forms, but to raise his soul, nature, so as to achieve again the illumination that the Vedas had originally given as if by grace? An answer is provided by Krishna to his pupil Arjuna in the sublime Gita. Such a soul would have to undergo a development expressed like this, quote, "Yes, it is true that you see the world in its outer forms, and when you are permeated with the knowledge of the Sankhya philosophy, you will see how these forms have developed out of the primal flow. You will also see how form after form changes. Your vision can follow the origin and dissolution of forms. Your eyes see the birth and death of forms. But when you consider thoroughly how these forms change, how form after form arises and vanishes. Then you are led to contemplate what comes to expression in all these forms. Accurate observation will lead you to the spiritual principle living in all these forms, transforming itself within them, sometimes more according to the sattva condition, at other times more after the forms of the other gunas, yet always freeing itself again from these forms. Such a thorough observation will direct you to something permanent, which, compared to form, is imperishable. The material principle, to be sure, is constant, but not the forms you see, which come into being, arise, and fade, which go through birth and death. Yet the soul spiritual element continues. Direct your attention to that. In order, however, to be able to experience this soul spiritual element within and around you and to identify it with yourself, you must develop the slumbering forces in your soul. You must yield yourself to yoga, which begins with looking up devotionally toward the soul spirit element of existence, and with the practice of certain exercises leads to the development of these slumbering forces. End quote. In this way, the pupil rises from stage to stage by means of yoga. Devotional reverence for the spiritual element of the soul is the other way that leads the soul forward to that spiritual element living in unity behind the changing forms, that element once proclaimed by the Vedas through grace and illumination. What is to be looked for behind all changing forms, the soul will again find through yoga. So a great teacher might have said to his pupil, quote, "Study the knowledge given in the Sankhya philosophy, in its forms, in the gunas, considering the conditions of sattva, rajas, and tamas, through the forms of the finest down to the coarsest substance. Study these with your understanding. Then admit that there must be something permanent, something unifying in it all. Then by thinking you will have penetrated to the eternal." But you can also begin with devotion. By means of yoga you can push on from stage to stage and ultimately reach the spiritual that is at the base of all forms. From two sides you can approach the eternal, through a thoughtful contemplation of the world and through yoga. Both will lead you to what the great teacher of the Vedas describes as the unitary Atman Brahman that lives in the outer world as well as in the inmost being of the soul, which in oneness exists at the world's foundation. On the one side you will attain it by thinking through the Sankhya philosophy, on the other through devotion by means of yoga. End quote. As I have shown in my pamphlet, The Occult Significance of the Blood, it is possible to look back to those ancient times when clairvoyant power was still united with human nature through the blood. But mankind has gradually advanced from that blood-bound clairvoyance to a kind more truly soul-spiritual. In order not to lose this connection with the soul-spiritual, naturally attained in those ancient times of close tribal and folk blood relationships, new methods and new and ways of teaching had to be found during the transition from the period of blood relationships to the time when these relationships no longer prevailed. It is the sublime song of the Bhagavad Gita that leads to this transition to new methods, and tells of the battle fought between the descendants of the two royal brothers of the lines of Kuru and Pandu. On one side is represented the age that was already past, when the story of the Gita begins, that time in which the old Indian perception still existed, and men still based their way of living upon it. In the blind King Dhritarashtra of the house of Kuru, we see the line that reaches over from ancient times into the new era. We see the king in conversation with his charioteer. He stands on the one side of the warriors. On the other side are the sons of Pandu, who are related to the others by blood, but who are fighting them, because they are in a state of transition from the old times to the new. King Dhritarashtra, who is characteristically described as blind because it is not the spiritual in this line, but the physical that is to be transmitted, is told by his charioteer what is happening on the other side among the sons of Pandu. To them is to pass for future generations what is of a more soul and spiritual nature. The charioteer tells the king how Arjuna, the representative of the Pandu warriors, is instructed by the great Krishna, the teacher of mankind. He tells how Krishna gives to his pupil Arjuna all the knowledge of which we have been speaking, of the possibility of achieving again, if thinking and devotion are developed through Sankhya and Yoga, what the great teachers of mankind had incorporated in the Vedas. In grandiose language, as much philosophical as poetical, we are told of the instruction given by Krishna, the great teacher of the New Age, that had abandoned the old blood relationships. Here something else shines through to us out of those ancient times. In the basic considerations of the pamphlet, The Occult Significance of the Blood, and elsewhere, I have indicated how the evolution of mankind proceeded from the time of the old blood relationships to later differentiations, whereby the striving of the soul was transformed. The noble song of the Bhagavad Gita leads directly to this transition. Through the instructions given to Arjuna by Krishna, it is made clear how men who no longer possess the old clairvoyance dependent upon the blood must press on to what is imperishable. The Gita thus stands as an illustration of what, from observing directly out of the events themselves, I have often spoken of as an important transition in the evolution of mankind. What particularly attracts us in the Bhagavad Gita is with what penetrating perception it speaks of man's path, of the way he must take to gain the enduring in contrast to the transitory. At the beginning of the poem, the charioteer, relating the happenings on the battlefield to King Dhritarashtra, pictures Arjuna standing there, his soul torn over the prospect of having to fight the Kurus, his blood relatives. Arjuna asks himself, quote, "Must I fight against those who are linked to me by blood?" Unquote. "Those who are the sons of my father's brothers. There are many heroes among us who must turn..." Arjuna asks himself, quote, "Must I fight against those who are linked to me by blood? Those who are the sons of my father's brothers? There are many heroes among us who must turn their weapons against their own relatives. On the opposite side, there are heroes just as honorable who must direct their weapons against us." Unquote. In great torment, he continues, quote, "Can I win this battle? Ought I win it? Do brothers dare to raise the sword against each other?" Unquote. Then Krishna, the great teacher, comes to him and says, quote, "First of all, give thoughtful consideration to human life and examine the circumstances in which you find yourself. In the temporal bodies of the Kurus, against whom you are to fight, live soul beings who are eternal, who only express themselves in these temporal forms. In your fellow warriors also live eternal souls, who only express themselves in the forms of the outer world. You will have to fight, for your law ordains it. This is for you to accomplish, decreed by the outer earthly evolution of humanity. You must do battle. This is the will of the moment that signifies the transition from one period to the other. Should you mourn that forms fight against other forms? Forms in transition, battling against other changing forms? Whatever of these forms will lead the others to death. What is death? What is life? The changing of forms is death, and it is life. Similar are the souls of those who are to be victorious to those who will now go to their death. What is this victory, and what is this death compared with that to which a thoughtful study of the Sankhya philosophy leads you? Compared to these eternal souls now opposing each other, yet remaining beyond the reach of battle." End quote. In this magnificent manner, out of the situation itself, we are led to see how Arjuna is shown that he should not suffer torments in his innermost being, but only do his duty calling him to battle, that he should look beyond what is passing and involves fighting to the eternal that lives on, whether as conqueror or as the conquered. So a powerful tone is sounded in a unique way in the sublime Gita, a tone heralding a significant event in human evolution, the perishable confronting the imperishable. We are on the right path when, instead of having abstract thoughts about the matter, we let its feeling content work upon us. We proceed in the right way when we perceive that Krishna, in his instruction, is trying to raise the soul of Arjuna from the stage at which it stands, entangled in the net of the transitory, to a higher stage, in which it will feel itself elevated beyond everything transitory, even when the transitory presents itself to the soul directly involved in such a distressing form as a victory or defeat, as inflicting death or suffering it. In the Bhagavad Gita we see verified a statement once made about the philosophy set forth in it. Quote, "The Eastern philosophy was at the same time so much a religion in those ancient times that a person given to it, however great and wise he may have been, was not without the deepest religious fervor. And the simplest man, who only lived the religion of feeling, was not without a certain amount of wisdom." Unquote. This we feel when we see how the great teacher Krishna not only influenced the ideas of his pupil Arjuna, but also worked directly into his feeling, bringing him to contemplate the transitory and the torments of the transitory existence. In such a significant situation, he raises Arjuna's soul to a height far above everything transitory, above all its miseries, pain, and sorrow. The end of Lecture 2.